Welcome to a podcast from the Irish Linen Centre and Lisburn Museum. My name is Kieran, and today I will be speaking to Dr. Ken Griffin, curator of the Egypt Centre of Swansea. In this podcast, we talk to Ken about his career path, his work at the museum, and his thoughts on some of the hot topics in Egyptology, including restitution, the display of human remains, and the implicit racism of TV's Ancient Aliens. Good afternoon, Ken, and welcome to Lisburn Museum.
I suppose the first thing that someone comes to the museum will notice tonight is that you have a slight North Belfast accent.
Yep.
Which maybe people weren't expecting, or they might have, I don't know. Can you tell us a wee bit about how you got into Egyptology and how you end up as a curator in the Egypt Centre in Swansea?
Yeah, sure. So my interest in Egyptology has always been something that I developed at a very young age. I used to get my dad to take me to the Ulster Museum since I was around 6 years of age. And the earliest memory that I can think of was when we were in P2. So what age is that? Five or something like that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, five or six.
Five or six, and going to the Ulster Museum and seeing the small Egyptian collection that they had there, including the mummy of Takhaboudi. And that just always really fascinated me. It was them and dinosaurs, like most kids, I think, not just back then, but also today. But of course, not many people actually go on to do their dream kind of job. I've been fortunate enough that I was kind of obsessed with both of those, and especially Egypt, when my dad took me on my 16th birthday. So that was my first experience of really going to the country, and that really consolidated my love for all things Egypt and just really wanted to do Egyptology. And there's very few places in the UK that do it. So Swansea in Wales, that was one of the few places. And they had recently opened a museum called the Egypt Centre. So that opened to the public in 1998. And then as a degree scheme in Egyptology, they started in 2000. So it was initially a joint honours, Egyptology and Ancient History. So I started that year, and I was the first year for students to be doing Egyptology. I loved Swansea so much. It's got a lot of similarities with Belfast, to be honest. So I kind of felt really at home there. I started off volunteering in the museum as soon as I arrived. I even remember the date, the 3rd of October 2000, when I started in the Egypt Centre the first time I walked in there. And I've been associated with the museum ever since, as a volunteer, as a paid member of staff, working my way up, and now I'm the curator of the collection.
And as a curator in the museum, like, what is your day-to-day work involved? Mm-hmm. I mean, how does your week unfold?
Yeah, so it kind of varies each week. As we're a university-based museum, we obviously have a lot of university students. So we may, for example, have university student groups that are in research in the collection, either individually or perhaps as part of a module. So what we pride ourselves at the Egypt Centre is doing a lot of object-centred learning, where we make the collection available to students, to lecturers, by taking the objects either off display, out of storage, bringing them into a room where students get to handle them, to research them, sometimes to write a life cycle project or a dissertation on the objects. So it would often be getting objects ready for that, or I could be researching aspects of the collection, updating our online catalogue, preparing exhibitions. So we recently received a loan of around about 800 objects from Harrogate Museum for the next 3 years. And for that, we'll be developing three exhibitions. The first one, which will start in October the 7th. So that's going to be on causing their name to live, which is an expression that the ancient Egyptians use to really kind of remember their ancestors. Mm-hmm. So I've chosen 30 objects in which we've been able to reveal the names of the owners of these objects, and sometimes their mothers, fathers, other family members.
Mm-hmm. Wow, okay. And what about the collection? I mean, how did it get put together? Where is it from? What's mm-hmm. the provenance? Can you tell us a wee bit about it?
Yeah. So the collection itself was originally formed in 1971 as part of the dispersal of the Wellcome Collection in London. So Henry Wellcome died in 1936, and at the time of his death, his collection was over 1 million objects. So it was five times bigger than the Louvre in Paris, just to put that into perspective. Absolutely amazing amount of objects, but most of it, because it was purchased at auction, was kept in boxes, in warehouses, and obviously the rental rates in London were starting to go up and up and up. So the trustees of the Wellcome decided that they would disperse the collection. A lot of the non-Egyptological material went to different museums mm-hmm. throughout the world. So there were over 100 different institutions who received objects. Mm-hmm. And in 1971, it was decided to disperse the Egyptian collection. So several universities and museums were offered the chance. The Petrie Museum in London, who specialise in the Egyptology, they were the ones responsible for selecting this. And the collection was really dispersed between Liverpool, Durham, Birmingham and Swansea. Roughly a collection of, I would say, around 16,000 objects. Henry Wellcome's Egyptian collection was probably closer to somewhere in the region of 20,000, wow, which is a staggering amount, really. Yeah. So in September 1971, 92 crates of objects arrived in Swansea. And the condition was that the boxes had to be taken unseen. So it wasn't a case of going through the boxes and thinking, oh, this is a good object, let's take it to Swansea. Okay. It was a case of you take what you're given. Yeah. So you can just imagine these were brought back to Swansea. And Kate Boss Griffiths, who was an Egyptologist, and the wife of Gwyn Griffiths, a classicist in Swansea, both of them were trained Egyptologists and classicists. She was appointed as the honorary curator. And she had to sort out the collection and make it available for researchers, for students, and build a small museum around that.
Yeah, okay. Wow.
So that opened in the small museum in 1976. And then thanks to funding from the National Lottery and European Regional Development, we were able to create the Egypt Centre as a purpose-built museum. So that opened in 1998. So this is our 25th anniversary, and we're having a celebratory event in 3 weeks' time.
Wow, I'm still going strong too. So we were chatting earlier on, Egyptian collections and museums in Britain and Ireland have went through different phases, you know, cabinets of curiosity to Victorian models of, you know, expert visitor to, you know, museums are now about co-curation and community engagement and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You from explaining to me earlier have and your museum have a particular approach to dealing with say controversial issues in Egyptology, such as human remains and their display. I wonder if you could talk a wee bit about that. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. So we have always had a policy at the Egypt Centre, mainly from our first curator of the Egypt Centre collection, Carolyn Graves Brown, of not displaying human remains to the public for ethical reasons. There's pros and cons for both. Should human remains of any culture or of any age be put on display to be seen almost as curiosities? And especially since we have a large school groups that come in to the galleries, and certainly I have seen in museums where you often have school kids who go around and they kind of point at a mummy and they kind of laugh and joke and don't realise that this is actually a real person. So there is reasons for doing it, but on the other hand, I do see that human remains can be displayed in such a way that they are memorialized, but also done with dignity. And I think they do that at the Cairo Museum and the Luxor Museum in Egypt very well. So with a nice darkened room, people are told that they shouldn't be talking while they're inside the room, etc. So they're given that information. And I also feel that human remains can be very much objects that kind of really ignite people's imagination, but also their interest in the topic. If it wasn't for the mummy of Takaboudi to be displayed in the Ulster Museum, I probably wouldn't be sitting here today talking to you or working in a museum. So they really do inspire people. At the Egypt Centre, though, we don't have a complete body. We have arms, legs, feet, heads, things like that, which are not so nice to put on display, I don't think, especially for children. Maybe it would be different if we had a complete body who was wrapped, and maybe similar to the Ulster Museum, you would expose a foot and a hand and the head so that you don't have the whole body exposed or covered, but you can see a little bit about them. At the same time, fitting in with the theme that I mentioned earlier, the Egypt Centre exhibition we're putting on, causing their name to live. This is something that I think that is important to the Egyptians, is to cause their name to live. By putting that mummy on display, we are saying the name Takaboudi. For the ancient Egyptians, that is causing their name to live. That's allowing them to have an afterlife. If her mummy wasn't on display, would anybody know who she was? Probably not. So I think that's important. And I think it's also important to note that Herodotus tells us that when he visited Egypt around 450 or so BC, people would go into the catacombs and they could look upon the mummies of their ancestors. So they were displayed in a certain capacity 2,500 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it is one of those questions that does raise a lot of controversy.
Yeah, and there's no easy answer or simple answer.
There's not. Know? There's no right answer.
Yeah. So you're here at the museum because you're giving a talk tonight as mm-hmm. part of the museum's Egyptian series.
Yep.
We have the British Museum touring exhibition, Egyptian Hieroglyphs, Unlock the Mystery. Have you seen the exhibition? Have you thought much about decipherment? Can you speak at all about what decipherment did for the study of Egypt and ancient Egypt?
Yeah, so I had the chance to see the exhibition this morning, and it's really great. I was looking forward to seeing it because, unfortunately, I couldn't get to see the one at the British Museum because of the strikes that were taking place in the final week when I was planning to go there. So it was nice to kind of get to see the 10 or so objects that were brought over from London to be on display. There's really some fascinating ones and some very exciting and well-known objects from the British Museum collection. So, for example, they have the papyrus of Nesitaneb Isheru, which is the original one when it was found was 37 meters in length.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely extraordinary. One of the longest papyri ever. And that was found in the Deir el-Bahari cache, which we were talking about quite recently.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a masterpiece. And quite frankly, I'm surprised that it's here because as far as I know, the British Museum, they've only really displayed it I think once before, and that was for an exhibition on the Book of the Dead just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But because obviously you've got pigment on there, which is susceptible to light damage, they haven't really put it on display in their galleries before. So it is nice that it is here, there. And another wonderful object that you have is the ancestor bust.
Mm-hmm.
The ancestor bust is basically an object that was made at Deir el-Medina, a community of workmen responsible for carving the tombs in the Valley of the Kings. And when I was talking earlier about causing their name to live, this fits in with the entire theme. It's got the name of the individual on the front, and this was placed inside the home in order for relatives to not worship, but remember, to memorialize their deceased ancestor. So fitting in with the Egyptian theme of mm-hmm. causing their name to live.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the decipherment, though, it's quite scary in a way to think that it was only hieroglyphs were only deciphered 201 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We're just past the 200th anniversary of Champollion managing to crack the code of reading Egyptian hieroglyphs. So our knowledge of Egyptian hieroglyphs is still, you could say, in its infancy. We're still learning new things about the language. Scholars are working on it, but it's advanced so much over the last 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it is fantastic. I mean, I work in a tomb in Egypt, and sometimes we're finding inscriptions that possibly haven't been read in thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
It's really exciting.
Yeah, can you talk a wee bit about your excavations in Egypt? I mean, it's something I think we're all interested in hearing about.
So I've been part of several projects working in Egypt, as well as Sudan over the last 13 years or so. But the main project I work in is called the South Asasif Conservation Project. It's really emphasizing that excavations in Egypt are not simply treasure hunts. They're not looking for objects all the time. But there's a lot of other things that have to be done on there. The documentation, the publication, the conservation of the sites as well, to ensure that they are going to survive for generations to come. So the South Asasif Necropolis is on the west bank of Luxor. And basically what you've got is a 25th dynasty necropolis there, dating to around about 750 BC. This is a time when the Nubians were controlling Egypt. The Nubians coming from modern Sudan. And you've got three large tombs in the area of these elite officials, one of whom is called Karak Amun. Now, the tomb itself has been known for 200 years, and it was recorded by an Egyptologist called Lepsius in the 1840s. But the tomb already at that stage had started to collapse. And in the last 150 years or so, a village was built on top of the tombs, which completely really submerged the tomb, and it became lost. People didn't know where it was for the last few decades. People expected that the tomb was completely destroyed. And then work started in 2006. And during that season, they uncovered the tomb, the end, or at least part of the tomb. found that it wasn't destroyed, but in fact there were a lot of inscriptions still left on the wall. Unfortunately, the tomb had largely collapsed. So during the next 5 or 6 years of excavations, we found 20 to 30,000 fragments inscribed with hieroglyphs of various chapters from the Book of the Dead, the pyramid texts, the ritual of the hours of the day and night. And they're all formulaic ones. So we have papyri and other documents where they're written. So my job, and I started there in 2010, was to identify these inscriptions, to find a fragment, look at the hieroglyphs on there. Can I identify what the words are? Can they be placed to a specific chapter, etc.? And then to rebuild the tomb. And that's something that we've been doing since then. So we have completely rebuilt the tomb in terms of new limestone. We still have thousands of fragments. And what we're doing when we identify them is cutting a pocket into the limestone and inserting them into the stone itself to rebuild this tomb, which we hope will be open to the public in a few years' time.
Yeah, that's amazing. You're doing this large hieroglyphic jigsaw.
It is. It's a massive jigsaw. Yeah. Probably the largest jigsaw puzzle in the world, you could say. It's, yeah. But every year we're having so much success. And with the ritual of the hours of the night, which is one of the texts I'm working on, part of that ritual is found in other tombs. But we have, for example, the fifth hour of the night. And that text is only known from two sources, the tomb of Karakamun and a papyrus from the Roman period. And the papyrus from the Roman period is very much heavily destroyed. So when we find new fragments from the tomb of Karakamun, we're sometimes reading a brand new inscription that hasn't been done in several thousand years. It's really exciting.
That's incredible, yeah. So you can read hieroglyphs?
I can, yeah. Although hieroglyphs is such a big word in a way, because the language developed considerably over the 3,000 years of Egyptian history. So while Middle Kingdom hieroglyphs is the standard that most people in university would learn, those date to about 2000 BC. If you're looking at hieroglyphs from, let's say, the Roman period, 2000 years later, they're substantially different. So while most people who do hieroglyphs could read the New Kingdom or the Middle Kingdom stuff, they may not necessarily be able to read the Ptolemaic stuff and Roman stuff.
So how do you deal with that? Do you have to go and look at other texts? Do you have to get advice? Or
dictionaries? Yeah, right, okay. Yeah. Unfortunately, there's a number of websites now where you can use as online dictionaries for searching words, looking at the different hieroglyphs and to see how they work. Because a lot of the grammar, it does change, but you can kind of piece together as to what you're getting there.
Okay. Come on to my last question now. So you've spent your career, lifetime, looking at Egypt and Egyptology. What is it about Egypt? Why is it not just your career, but the career of hundreds of other archaeologists and the general public is captivated by ancient Egypt? Why do you think it is? What's that essence?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think maybe the mystery of the country, there's just so much, but also the fascination with what they were able to achieve, building these massive monuments such as pyramids, some of the biggest temples ever produced. They're tombs that are beautifully decorated. And if you walk into some of the tombs and you see the decoration there, it's as fresh as it was when it was painted 3,000 years ago. So you can't help but fall in love with it. And I have to say as well, it's not just the ancient Egyptian side of things, but having visited Egypt over 60 occasions, Egypt as a country today, as a modern culture, is also just as fascinating and interesting. And the Egyptian people are so friendly, really nice, and I just love being there. The food is excellent as well.
I feel like I should ask this last question. It's a bit tongue-in-cheek. I asked Alona about, did aliens build the pyramid?
Did aliens build the pyramid? Well, I did see yesterday NASA were doing a news briefing about aliens, in which they aliens don't exist. So there's your answer. No, definitely they didn't build the pyramids. I think this is one of these things that a lot of people now would say this is down to racism. That people say, well, the aliens built the pyramids because how could a race from Africa, who are inferior to what we are today, possibly build these monuments when we can't do something like that today? In reality, if we wanted to build a pyramid, we could build a pyramid, and we could do it much quicker because we have a better technology. But this is what the Egyptians were able to do. It's very basic stonework. people often say, well, pyramids, they have them in Egypt, they have them in South America, they have them in different civilizations. Mm-hmm. That must mean that you had an advanced race who was influencing them. But again, it's very logic from an architectural point of view. If you're building higher, if you do it straight without sloping edges, it's going to collapse. Mm-hmm. If you're building it with edges that are going inwards on themselves, then you're creating a stable platform. Mm-hmm. And this is what the Egyptians are doing. Mm-hmm. But they also associate the shape of the pyramid with the sacred Benben stone, which is the Egyptians believed at the beginning of creation. There was nothing but water, and out of water sprung this island in the shape of a almost pyramidal structure. Mm-hmm. And it's from that all life came from. Mm-hmm. So they're tombs. They're clearly tombs. There's burial chambers in there with coffins. Sometimes the bodies of the kings are even found within them. Mm-hmm. They're not built by aliens whatsoever.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that. I was reading that Angela Steen book on mummies. Mm-hmm. She talks about like early 19th century racial theories.
Yes.
About the hunt for the white Egyptian, because people thought that there was no way Egyptians could have invented or built the pyramids and also have been black. I mean, racist to the core. But that, as you pointed out, is an idea that sort of, it's lasted over time. It's just the question is asked in a different way now. Mm-hmm. You know, did aliens build the pyramid? You know?
Yes, yeah. And unfortunately, there's too many ancient aliens programs on TV.
Yeah.
Which I would urge your listeners to not watch.
Yeah, don't watch ancient aliens. Yeah, we asked that question tongue-in-cheek, and I mean, Alona battled it right back and gave this really interesting explanation for, you know, with the records of the people who were involved in building it. And you've also identified another element, the racial part of that, you know, the inherent racism in asking that question. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a useful way sometimes of like doing public history. You ask a question that people have heard or they're aware of, but it actually brings you down into from a sort of, a silly entry, you get a really interesting proper answer, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, we do get that question a lot at the YouTube Center. Did the aliens build the pyramids? And as Alona said, that we've got a lot of evidence that the ancient Egyptians clearly built them. Mm-hmm. They've written us documents, a manual that was discovered quite recently in the Red Sea port gives documents of one of the people responsible for building the pyramid of Khufu, the Great Pyramid, mm-hmm. in which he was bringing stone from one place of Egypt to the other mm-hmm. in order to construct this monument. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the questions that our education team said that the kids, so visitors to the museum often ask us, did people get trapped in pyramids? And they say this comes up all the time at workshops, so I feel like I should ask.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I had a question today, actually, from one of the people who was doing the school group, and they said, are there any booby traps in Egypt? Did they have them in the pyramids? Yes, they did actually have traps, various traps, especially when you get to the Middle Kingdom pyramids, where they'll try and create almost a labyrinth of a maze-like kind of structure inside the pyramid, so that people would go to dead ends, or they might fall in a hole and things like that. But in reality, there's not usually traps that you do find in these monuments. Mm-hmm. That being said, sometimes people do get trapped, because what you'll find is the robbers will not necessarily go in the original entrance to the tomb, but they may carve a new entrance into it, and sometimes that might collapse on top of them. Mm-hmm. So there have been a number of cases where bodies have been found, which are clearly those of the tomb robbers that have got trapped inside the tomb.
Oh dear. This is not something you have to worry about in your excavation, thankfully.
I mean, the worst thing that we have to do when we're maybe excavating the tomb is potentially going into a room that hasn't been entered in years, and you find there might be a snake or a scorpion in there. That's which right. is hasn't been put there by the ancient Egyptians, but
I fancy my chances with the traps
exactly.
over the snakes. Listen, Ken, thanks very much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you and drawing on your expertise, so thanks very much.
You're very welcome, and thanks for inviting me.